Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris and you're watching Consider This. Tonight on the show, I have Professor Sabina Elkaya, who is a director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, or better known as OPHI, in the University of Oxford. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been such a pleasure.
So Professor Sabina is perhaps best known for developing, along with James Foster, the Elkaya-Foster method for measuring multidimensional poverty. So this was also developed for the UNDP's Human Development Report, and today that's a topic we're going to be discussing. We're going to be looking at the measurement of poverty. Poverty has traditionally been measured using a poverty line, and we want to ask Professor Sabina today to talk to us a bit about that. So are there benefits to using a monetary measure in terms of looking at addressing poverty in a country?
A monetary measure.
Using the poverty line.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you still see that it's relevant today.
Yeah,
okay.
We need to know about money because money buys many discretionary things. We want to give somebody a gift. We want to buy a bit of lipstick. You know, it's important to have freedom. It's important to be able to express. And there are many things that money can buy, and poor people can just address it within their own households without services or external supports. So monetary poverty remains fundamentally important, but insufficient.
Okay. Well, talk to me about the insufficiencies, because there are drawbacks to just using a poverty line. We've seen that in Malaysia as well, when the UN Special Rapporteur for Extreme Poverty had a visit and made the observation that Malaysia's poverty line does not reflect the situation on the ground.
Yeah. Mm. So I'm an economist, and I was trained that money is a good proxy for malnutrition. It's a good proxy for children out of school. It's a good proxy for lack of good housing. But now we have microdata that we didn't in the 1990s or whatever. And now we can see much more precisely the mismatch. And it's not only in developing countries or developing countries like Malaysia, but it's also in Europe. Mm-hmm. So just to give an example, in Europe, there's a mismatch between people who are monetary poor, people experiencing quasi-joblessness, and people who are materially deprived in the sense that they might not have two pair of shoes, they might not have opportunity to eat meat, fish, or the vegetarian equivalent twice a week, they might not have a holiday, they might not be able to heat their houses. And this is a surprise because it's things money can buy. Mm. But what we find all over Europe is that there's a mismatch. And so now Europe measures all of them. It measures joblessness, at risk of monetary poverty, and material deprivation together. And it does so to bring into view deprivations that poor people are experiencing. And that's also the case if we think of health and education. Mm. One of the big surprises is that monetary poverty, even by a food basket, is not a good predictor of malnutrition in the household. Now, is that because of intra-household inequalities? Is that because of a lack of knowledge of how to spend the money? Is it because we have different metabolic needs? There are many complexities.
Okay.
But just knowing we have enough money to eat doesn't mean we do eat.
So these deprivation profiles, they seem to be unique to the individual.
Mm.
So, I mean, how do you measure? Could you talk to me a little bit more about the, measuring deprivation?
Yeah.
So you have different categories. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, when people hear the word multidimensional, six syllables, it's really long, really complicated. But actually, it's simpler than monetary poverty. So basically, you think of what are the key deprivations. Now, Malaysia, that conversation is ongoing. With UNDP, we do a global MPI. And there are three dimensions, health, education, and living standard. And there are 10 indicators. So are you deprived? One, do you have a malnourished person in your household who's stunted or underweight as a child, who has a low body mass index as an adult? That's your first deprivation. You can say yes or no.
Right.
Second, very sadly, has a child died in the last 5 years? You know that, yes or no. Thirdly, does anybody in your household have 6 years of schooling so they can read for the other members of the household? Could be a child 11 years of age, could be grandma. If you do, you're not deprived. But if nobody in the household has 6 years, you are.
Okay.
Is a child not attending school from ages 6 to 14? If so, you're deprived. If not, you're not deprived. Do you have clean water? Yes or no. Adequate sanitation? Yes or no. Electricity? Yes or no. A good quality house? Yes or no. assets, clean energy. So you can make for yourself, and we make using household survey for each person, a deprivation profile of yes or no, are we deprived in each of these 10 indicators.
Okay.
But one deprivation isn't poverty. Because I might have a low body mass index, you might,
right?
Because you're a fashion model. So you might need it as part of your job. Or somebody might have no years of schooling, but they're a multimillionaire.
Right.
And so we only identify a person as poor if they have a critical mass of deprivations at the same time. In the global MPI, they're deprived in 1/3 of the weighted indicators.
So 1/3 would mean they have fallen under the category of deprived.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then when we do that, then it becomes simple. Because you can say, okay, what percentage of people in my country are poor? Which means what percentage of people are deprived in more than 1/3 of these indicators? And then you can do that. And then, well, what percentage of indicators on average are they deprived in? We call that intensity, because more is worse.
Right.
So it's worse if I'm deprived in 90% than in 34%. But either case, I'm poor. So we also then look at intensity. And then the MPI is something I think a third grader could do, because you multiply the percentage of people who are poor times the average percentage of deprivations poor people explain. So it just requires multiplication.
Okay.
And then you get the MPI.
Are you able to calculate this for the world? I mean, different countries? I mean, based on the criteria that you talked about, were you able to put a number to how many people fall within the different deprivations?
Yes, with UNDP, we estimate this now for 5.7 billion people, 101 countries.
Okay.
Very sadly, Malaysia is not among them. But of those 5.7 billion people, 1.3 billion, which is 23% of people in the developing world, are multidimensionally poor.
1.3 billion people
are
multidimensionally poor.
Yeah, so they're deprived in more than 1/3 of those 10 weighted indicators.
And are they spread equally throughout the world? Are they concentrated on different continents?
Yeah. Most of them live in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. So poverty levels are highest in Sub-Saharan Africa, where 57% of people are poor. In South Asia, it's 31%, but South Asia has more people. So it has roughly the same number of poor people, very sadly. In East Asia Pacific, where we are in Malaysia, on average, 5.6% of people are poor. We cover 2 billion people in East Asia. And it ranges from less than 1% in Thailand to 46% in East Timor.
Wow. Okay, so there are huge disparities in this. I think we'll come back and discuss a little bit more how the multidimensional poverty index will change the way policymakers respond to poverty. That's coming up next on Consider This. Stay with us. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. I'm chatting tonight with Professor Sabina Alkaya, who directs the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, a research center in the Department of International Development at the University of Oxford. Just before the break, Professor Sabina, you talked about Malaysia not being part of this multidimensional poverty index, right? The global MPI. Why is Malaysia not involved in this?
So we use data that are publicly accessible, and so we use demographic and health surveys funded by USAID and multiple indicator cluster surveys for about 93 countries, and then PAPFAM for a couple, and then national data sets for China and Mexico and Brazil and Ecuador and Jamaica. But we don't have data yet for Malaysia that are in the public domain that we can use, and we haven't been requested to use other data sets.
Okay.
So I'm here and I would love to know what the MPI for Malaysia is.
And many of us would do. I mean, I think it was important to kind of really, you know, to create good policy, you need first the data to show where the policy is needed the most. And the conversation about availability of data, especially disaggregated data, has been one that's been ongoing in Malaysia. Talk to me a little bit about sensitivity of data, especially disaggregated data, in your work? Is this a common fear, a common thread that you see when you work in different countries?
It really depends on the country context. I mean, in some countries now for years, the data are in the public domain, they're disaggregated, and it's fine. But in a number of cases, they're not disaggregated by politically sensitive categories, or they're just starting to be. Mm. So I'll give an example from Mexico. Now, this is of a national human development, multidimensional poverty index. And we had the honor to work with Mexico in 2009 when it launched its first MPI in 2010. and they had state levels of poverty, but they've never disaggregated by indigenous identity. Mm. And a lot of the poorest groups in Mexico are from the indigenous groups. And so there was quite a bit of nervousness the night before they launched. And the nervousness was not about the methodology, about having a new multidimensional poverty index versus income, though they were the first country to do it. Right. And it wasn't about disaggregating it by gender or by state, which they also did, but they were nervous about the indigenous groups. And then they released it, and there was a very positive response. Because I think in Mexico, everybody knew that the indigenous groups were the poorest. Okay. And this somehow validated it, it made it public. And so people could just get to work. But it was a huge difference. So in Mexico, in the first release, 43% of people were poor, and 10% were in extreme poverty. Wow. But when you move to the indigenous people, 75% were poor, and 39% were in extreme poverty. So it was just a huge disparity.
Yes.
But that meant people could get to work, they could see it come down. And one of the joys is that Oaxaca, which is a state with a high proportion of indigenous people, between 2016 and 2018, which is the most recent time they updated their MPI, they updated every 2 years, Oaxaca had the fastest reduction of all the states.
Wow.
And so again, there's a kind of a joy because it's catching up.
Because you've addressed the problem and you were able to then implement policies that will be able to address the underlying issues. How have you seen, the MPI change the way policymakers civil society talk about and respond to poverty? Has that changed the way we've discussed the word poverty?
I think so. I mean, I'll give three examples. One is in the Sustainable Development Goals. The goal one, the first goal of 17, is end poverty in all its forms. Mm-hmm. There's 169 targets. The first is to end $1.90 a day poverty. Mm-hmm. And the second is to end multidimensional poverty. And it's recognized that ending poverty is the biggest global challenge. And so that recognition that there is a multidimensionality to poverty is embedded in the SDGs. I think another is just the uptake of work. We had the honor in 2013 to launch a policy network of countries that were interested in national MPIs. Mm-hmm. Alongside the global MPI we do for over 100 developing countries. There were 16 countries in Oxford in 2013 with President Santos of Colombia, Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate in economics, to launch the network. But now there are 60.
Wow.
60. And so that community is growing, developing national MPIs and using them. They have events with heads of state and with ministers in General Assembly and other places. And the third is that I think that there's what people find valuable in the multidimensional measure is two different things. One is tractability and the other is visibility. So tractability, the indicators of the MPI are things like putting children in school, water, sanitation, or whatever services are needed. They're things that regularly governments, NGOs, private sector groups do. Mm. And the joy of the MPI is that if you reduce any deprived dimension of a poor person, MPI goes down that year.
Okay.
If you put a child in school, the child has to finish school, go out, get a job, until income poverty goes down. So there's a big lag.
Right.
But the MPI is visible, direct, and you can get it down. I'll give an example. In 2010 and 2008, 2010, Mexico updated their MPI after the 2008 financial crisis. Income poverty went up. Food insecurity went up because of the food price shock. But the five other indicators of the Mexican MPI went down. So it could make visible kinds of progress that the government was doing that monetary poverty couldn't. So that's one.
Yes, okay, and the second?
So the other is that it's visible. So people call it a high resolution lens because you can have a national average. So Mr. or Mrs. President, Prime Minister can say poverty went down and give a ballpark figure. Mm. But then you can disaggregate it by state or province. And then you can break it apart by each of the indicators.
Wow.
And so that means that if I'm the governor of this area, I know what poverty looks like in my area. If I'm the person in charge of health within a state, I know what my indicators look like. And so whether it's budget allocation, whether it's targeting of programs, whether it's coordination of ministries, you have just gathered together an information platform. And the SDGs focus on integrated or multi-sectoral policies because they have a bigger impact.
Right.
And so the MPI is a good tool because it sort of gives a bird's eye view, not on every SDG, but on a bunch of them that are connected with each other.
Well, this seems to me like, you know, it's a win-win situation. So why is it that it's been only adopted by 60 countries, the national MPI? What's the hesitation of all the other countries in adopting a national MPI?
I think it's just time.
Okay.
I mean, I think
so. They'll get there eventually.
Absolutely.
Malaysia will get there too.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. We'll come back and continue this conversation with Professor Sabina right here on Consider This. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Thank you for staying with us on Consider This. I'm Lisa Idris. I'm talking to Professor Sabina Alkaya from the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative. We're talking about the Multidimensional Poverty Index. I also want to touch on how, I guess, we can understand the new inequalities that have emerged. Now, during the UNDP Human Development Report, when it was launched globally, there was a lot of talk about the two seismic shifts that are coming, the disruptors that are coming in the next year, the following years. You know, if we don't address the inequalities that could arise from technological advancements or changes, or from climate change-related shocks, we are in danger of having inequality widened. Could you talk a little bit about these new and emerging inequalities and how best to respond to them?
Yes, so the Human Development Report 2019 was focused on going beyond averages, going beyond income, going beyond today. And what they found was that if you look at poverty, that's familiar territory and we can already see inequalities, great inequalities in poverty. But then if you look at other things, the inequalities are rising even more. So they talked about enhanced capabilities. So let me give some simple examples, just more close to the original and very familiar topics. We talk a lot about education in human development. But if you look at tertiary education and the percentage of enrollment, people in tertiary education, the gap in countries is actually increasing, not decreasing. And similarly, if you look at the life expectancy of people who are today 70 years old, right? So I'm 70. How many more years can I expect to live? That gap in life expectancy is actually increasing between countries.
Okay.
Now if we shift to things like internet access, internet usage, controlling the carbon footprint and its growth, these similarly, you know, they're increasing. And so the quote-unquote countries that you would think to be more progressive, yes, they have a greater internet penetration and all of that, but they also maybe aren't controlling some of the environmental changes as accurately or shifting their trajectories so quickly. And so the report was saying actually we need to keep all of these in mind because, first of all, artificial intelligence and its impact on the job market will be in some senses negative, but also in order to take advantage of the new technologies, we need to train our young people differently. We need to get them very much tech savvy. And the curriculum isn't catching up as quickly as it needs to for the next workforce to be able to really participate as effectively as they should. Mm. And so looking ahead, looking around the corners, on these two topics in particular of technology and climate are fundamental.
Right, yeah, and policymakers often tend not to look at these new and emerging inequalities because we're so busy addressing the current issues at the moment. With climate-related shocks, who are the people most vulnerable or at risk of suffering from the disparities in inequality when it comes to this specific issue?
I think naturally I'm most aware of the overlaps. So if you map poverty and then you map environmental threats mm-hmm. like flooding or famine, or drought, forest fires, they tend to be the poorest right. that are in terms of numeric terms. But what's interesting is that when you overlay the map of climactic threats, rich are also affected. And so it's not simply disasters that affect the poor, as we see on the news these days. Mm. And in a sense, at your heart, you want nobody to be affected. But the interesting question would be, in this mix, could the rich, who are also vulnerable to having their properties flooded, or also vulnerable to wildfires coming, could they be part of the affected community, reshift their lens to see themselves part of the coastal community, and so try to protect not only their own houses, but all of the marginal coastal communities, mm-hmm. including the poor, from these, and think of more general solutions. And so I think it's a moment where we will see how the rich vulnerable, who don't think of themselves as vulnerable, but how right. they manage the climate threats, and whether we could create a new kind of solidarity. And to me, that's the exciting promise in the moment.
Okay. How do you even begin that conversation? Just trying to change the lens of perhaps rather than looking at, you know, income inequality, but rather part of a community that's at risk of climate-related shocks.
I mean, I'm a data person. And so I think what is interesting is just when you define groups that are at risk of climactic disasters and then talk with them, and then they'll look at each other and say, well, we're pretty different from each other.
Right.
But if they realize their commonality, then it might be, again, a chance to try to create a new community. It's a big ask. It's a low probability. And yet, if we don't press the moment, it won't come to be.
Definitely. I also want to talk a little bit about your work with the Center of Bhutan Studies in the Royal Government of Bhutan. So you had worked on Bhutan's Gross National Happiness Index, yes?
Yes.
So how is that? Would you categorize that as a good measurement of a country's well-being, as opposed to perhaps the standard GDP measurement?
Very much so. For me, it is a wise measure. We have the World Happiness Report also, which has one indicator, or you know, a small set of indicators.
Right.
But they are of a Western idea of happiness. And so if you look at the happiest countries and you look at their planetary impact, they're hurting the planet. And what's interesting in Bhutan's Gross National Happiness Index is that it's a very balanced spectrum. It's 9 dimensions of well-being. So we have health, education, living standards, the same as the Human Development Index. Then we have governance, bringing in the political. Mm. Then we have the environment, bringing in the climate. Then we have time use, because some of us are too busy. Leisure is so fulfilling, and we really have to think about it. Then we have culture, so forms of art, creative arts, expression. And then community, so relationships, but also donations of time and of money, but relationships of family, of belonging, of loneliness. And then we have psychological well-being, which is positive emotions like joy and generosity and kindness, lack of negative ones like stress, anxiety, frustration, and rage. It's spirituality and meaning. So there are these profound things that we sometimes are a little bit shy to talk about, and yet at the end of the day, they're quite important. Mm. And so this culture, community, psychological well-being brings into the picture some of the softer side of well-being without leaving out the fact that we still need houses that protect us from the rain. We still need meaningful jobs that we go to that give us a sense of purpose and of giving. So it seems a very wise measure.
Is Bhutan the only country currently using a Gross National Happiness Index?
To my knowledge, it's the only with such an index as an official statistic, but okay. there are other countries developing them. And I think it'll be very interesting. There have been NGOs or academia who have done them in other countries, but the kind of embeddedness into the public policy process, I think is just starting in some other countries.
What do you think that's changed, Bhutan being the first country to do this? And, you know, I'm just wondering whether a country that could be considered a superpower, economic superpower in the world, or one with slightly more visibility, or, you know, perhaps even the G10, would that be a realistic idea of having, see, the G20 countries, G7 countries, to adopt a gross national happiness index? Could we see the day?
I hope so. So I live in the UK, and with some national data as an academic study, I'll be doing a GNH index.
Oh, wow.
Just to look at it. But I think that two things. One is when Bhutan updated its GNH index in 2015, it had grown.
Okay.
So it had an increase in GNH. But it was driven by material indices of housing and income. It had the fastest growth in the world for one quarter. Living standards, health, education, those all had gone up. But it was interesting because what had come down, my sense of belonging, my negative emotions of anger and frustration had gone up.
Uh-huh.
My joy had gone down. And my sense of community had gone down. And so there was a national conversation about it's good that it's growing, but what are we losing? And I think these conversations don't have a right answer, but their answer defines the culture. And so it's offering a space to have those conversations. I think that's one really important thing. And in the UK, where there's a ministry of loneliness,
yes,
where there's a lot of depression and anxiety, the cutting edge really is to bring these into the discussion without leaving the National Health Service and quality of education, which are grossly underfunded, mm-hmm, out. So I think in the UK, we really need a balance. And again, there's no right answer of how much to allocate across them, but I think we need them all in view.
Right.
And a GNH index helps to bring that into the conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been such an enlightening conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for Consider This. I'll catch you next time. Thank you for watching, and good night.